Elmer Davis presents the news. The American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations present Elmer Davis and his comprehensive commentary on today's news developments. For a better informed analysis of national and international events, listen to Mr. Davis every weekday evening at the same time. We'll hear from him in just a moment. First, a special announcement. We seem to have adopted the same attitude about the housing shortage as we have about the weather. Everyone talks a lot, but no one does anything about it. Well, there's a lot that some of us can do. For example, if you own a home with unused rooms, put them to good advantage, both for some homeless veteran and for yourself. Remodeling extra rooms into an apartment can be done at comparatively small cost. Another way is by sharing homes with veterans. Just as during the war, many families shared their homes with war workers. Many communities have established veterans housing centers so that all rental vacancies and all offers to share homes can be listed at one central point where home-seeking veterans may have first chance at them. And remember this above all, no veteran should be denied a home because his family includes small children. Now, here is Mr. Davis from Washington.
Senate debate on the minor peace treaties today brought out incidentally from Senator Vandenberg an assurance that any separate peace treaty with Germany, such as Mr. Hoover and others have discussed, would be an unavoidable last resort. It was fairly clear from Mr. Hoover's language that he so regarded it, but so many people have misunderstood him that it's useful to have this assurance from the man who is carrying most of the burden of foreign policy on the Hill. The question came up when Senator Barkley was pointing out the difficulty of our negotiating any separate treaties with Italy and the Balkan satellites, such as would be necessary if the treaties now before the Senate were disapproved. Mr. Johnson of Colorado then recalled the talk of separate treaties with Germany and Austria, and Mr. Vandenberg came down from the president's chair to point out that even if that entirely remote contingency, as he called it, should occur, it was very different from the treaty with Italy, which involved boundary lines on which all nations have agreed. Senator Bridges and Senator Eastland argued against ratification of the Italian and Balkan treaties, but there seems little doubt that they will all be approved when the Senate votes on them tomorrow. Meanwhile, the Hungarian minister in Washington said that he regarded the new communist-controlled government in his country as illegal and would refuse to recognize it. However, it will be difficult for the State Department to continue to recognize him as minister, since this would imply our refusal to recognize the new government, and that would be a little embarrassing when we're just about to ratify the Treaty of Peace with Hungary. The House of Representatives passed the conference version of the Taft-Hartley labor bill by a vote of 320-79, with 12 Republicans voting against it and 103 Democrats for it. So once again, as on the original passage of the Hartley bill, a majority of Democrats as well as Republicans in the House have supported restrictive labor legislation. And Mr. Halleck, the Republican leader, could reasonably claim that it is a bipartisan measure, a point which he raised as an argument against a presidential veto. The Senate will probably pass the bill tomorrow. Congressman Hoffman of Michigan, for whom even the original Hartley bill wasn't tough enough, and who refused to sign the conference report, moved to send the bill back to committee on the ground that the conference had put in a good deal of new material. But Speaker Martin overruled him, citing precedents all the way from Sam Rayburn back to Henry Clay. Mr. Hartley, reporting the bill, said he wasn't happy about all of it, but that he wanted a bill that could become law. In other words, one that could be passed over a presidential veto. And if, said Mr. Hartley, the president did veto it, that would prove that the CIO is the major power in the White House. And he darkly hinted that for any veto, Russian influence would be responsible. Democrats, with not much less irrelevance, quoted the Republican platform of 1944 against the bill. A more pertinent observation was made by Mrs. Norton of New Jersey, former chairman of the Labor Committee, when she said that Congress was punishing the whole labor movement for the sins of a few labor leaders. Whether you like this labor bill or not, there seems little doubt that for the state of mind that made it possible, Mr. John L. Lewis is more responsible than any other one man. And he may make one more contribution to making it law. Last week, he broke off his wage negotiations with northern and western coal operators, which might be merely a tactical move. And today, his representatives refused to meet the southern operators on what seems the trivial excuse that they had made their proposals public. Now, the operators, the southerners particularly, haven't been very cooperative either. But there are only 26 days left till the present miners' contract expires. Unless a new one is drawn in that time, the miners won't work. And any prolonged coal strike would create an emergency to meet which the government will have no power under present law after the end of this month. One of the several titles in the Taft-Hartley labor bill does give the government that power. And some Republican leaders have threatened that if the president should veto the bill, they wouldn't pass any separate bill giving him authority to deal with an emergency. Whether they mean that seriously, nobody knows. But if it looks as if we're going to have another coal strike next month, the president might feel that he couldn't afford to take the risk. Before passing the labor bill, the House spent some more time discussing the War Department appropriation. But without getting to a vote on it, or even on the amendment offered by Mr. Mann of Texas to restore $40 million that had been cut out of the funds for the Air Forces. One other amendment was offered today by Mr. Dirksen of Illinois, to cut the appropriation by an extra $125 million, which would have meant a reduction of 5,000 more in the number of officers, besides the 20,000 proposed by the committee, and of 30,000 in the number of enlisted men. The argument was that enlistments wouldn't be enough to make up the number of men the Army will lose next year, so they wouldn't need the money. But though the amendment was supported by Chairman Tabor of the Appropriations Committee, it ran into vigorous bipartisan opposition and was beaten by voice vote. The president talked to congressional leaders of both parties this morning, asking for extension of certain war powers which would otherwise expire at the end of this month. One of them is the Maritime Commission's authority to operate oil tankers, which is believed to be necessary to prevent an oil shortage in the East next winter. And besides, the president hopes for action on bills that have been introduced to continue allocation of some foods and export controls over certain products. Under Secretary of State Acheson, in his Mississippi speech last month, said that it is vitally important to renew this authority so that the government can ensure equitable distribution of commodities as between the domestic economy and the export demand. But Congress is going to have to work fast to get action on the bills extending that authority before the end of this month. The president also sent in another appeal for congressional action on universal military training, but nobody expects it at this session. The resignation of Sproul Braden, Assistant Secretary of State in charge of Latin American affairs, is the expected consequence of the White House announcement yesterday that Argentina had been restored to good standing in the lodge of Western Hemisphere republics. Ostensibly, Mr. Braden resigns because of personal reasons. But the tough policy toward the Perón government in Argentina, which he embodied, has now been abandoned. The White House statement yesterday that we are prepared to go on and conclude the Western Hemisphere Defense Treaty, which was provided for by the Chapultepec Conference 2 years ago, but which we have refused to consider until Argentina cleared out its Nazi refugees, this obviously meant that the President and the Secretary of State are satisfied with the degree of denazification in Argentina. Mr. Braden has felt that considerably more could and should be done. There have been two problems in Argentina: the presence and influence of German Nazis and native Argentine fascism, which shades into, or rather shades out of, militaristic nationalism. There are considerable fascist elements in the Perón government, but its form is democratic, and it was voted in by the people in a free and fair election a year ago last spring. Shortly before that election, Mr. Braden published the Blue Book on Nazi activities in Argentina, but its net effect was a backfire. It probably made more votes for Perón by rousing nationalist sentiment against what was represented as foreign interference than it cost him by its exposures of Nazi influence. Incidentally, it's worth remembering that in that argument, the South American Communist parties were on the side of Perón. Fascism didn't worry them. It was the United States that was their enemy. More recently, Ambassador Messersmith in Buenos Aires, on good terms with Perón, has become the symbol of the conciliatory policy as Braden was the symbol of the tough policy, but it's too easy to see these things as black and white. Messerschmitt kept pressing Perón to get rid of the Nazis, and a good deal has already been done in that direction, or at least has been announced. If some of the announced denazification has not been carried out in fact, that, according to advices from Buenos Aires, is not the fault of Messerschmitt or even of Perón. It is due to Argentine officials down the line who have dragged their feet and failed to carry out Perón's orders, though it must be said that nothing seems to have happened to them for so doing. For such progress as has been made in denazification, the persistent pressure exerted by Mr. Braden may deserve some of the credit. But the Braden policy was unable to do anything about purely Argentine fascism. Meanwhile, our army has been anxious for the conclusion of the Western Hemisphere Defense Treaty, which the Braden policy delayed. And for that and other reasons, Republican leaders have been demanding a change in our attitude toward Argentina. The President and the Secretary of State are now apparently convinced that even though the Perón government hasn't been thoroughly dry cleaned, it has had enough of the Nazi spots taken out to be worth trusting in some degree. It remains to be seen how useful a partner that government may be in any serious hemispheric collaboration. The British plan for partition of India has already roused some Indian suspicions. Correspondents at a news conference which Lord Mountbatten held today thought that if Hindustan eventually chose to be completely independent, while Pakistan preferred to remain a dominion in the British Commonwealth, that meant that there would still be British influence in India. But the British did the best they could to persuade the Indians to accept a united India from which the British could withdraw completely. These suspicions seem a little superheated. They do, however, reflect the fact that Pakistan, two widely separated areas with hundreds of miles of Hindustan in between, doesn't look like a very good prospect for any long existence as an independent state. The logical thing, of course, would be federation with the rest of India. But the Indians, like other members of the human race, don't always do what is logical. The reformed Chinese government seems to be getting off on the wrong foot. The recent student demonstrations demanding an end to the civil war, a demand, it must be said, to which the communists paid less attention than the government, has led to an epidemic of cracking down on the universities and the newspapers, which, says a correspondent of the New York Times, has wiped out many of the democratic gains made in the past year or two and has turned a good many students who were previously neutral into communist sympathizers. However, you'll have to say this much for the Chinese. Whether or not their crusade against communism works, they are evidently determined to employ the most modern instrumentalities developed by Western civilization. For there has been formed in Shanghai a committee on un-Chinese activities. And now, here is our announcer.
A mental genius who can explain Einstein's theory of relativity might be confused by today's conflicting news stories. Is that the way that you feel, that headlines and dispatches are oftentimes contradictory and almost next to impossible to interpret in the right light? Well, it's to be admitted that forming an unbiased, unprejudiced opinion on current affairs takes a bit of thinking and hearing on all sides of the story. But millions of Americans have learned to make it easy for themselves. They're arriving at decisions through discussions that get rolling every Thursday night on America's Town Meeting of the Air. Borrowing from the early American custom of town hall gatherings, this challenging radio forum has made the whole breadth of the country a town hall for the weighing of important national and worldwide issues. Topics like, how can we make a lasting peace with Germany? Is the American press really free? Should there be further limits on the right to strike? And on hand to argue these controversial questions, America's Town Meeting presents informed men and women such as Max Eastman, Major George Fielding Elliott, and Dorothy Thompson.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.